presenting a night of poetry and conversation called We Are Not Drowning, We Are Fighting, and that is going to happen tonight at 7 at the First Unitarian Church. Joanne speaks with her next on Voices from the Edge. This is KBOO.
On Thursday, September 29th, from 8 to 10 p.m., Grassroot News will celebrate Fall 2016 with P-Funk as we get up for the downstroke with a deconstruction and celebration of George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars. Dr. Funkenstein and his contribution to music will be examined, as well as politics on the national and local level. So join me Thursday, September 29th from 8 to 10 p.m. for the Mothership Connection on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Resolution Fest, October 1st through 8th in Portland. Resolution Fest is a week-long celebration of the people and communities reimagining the landscape of the tech industry. Over 8 days, the intersections of technology, identity, culture, community service, education, social change, collaboration, and creativity will be examined. There will be documentary screenings, a Women Who Code Portland Networking Night, a Hacker Lounge, and much, much more. Again, that's Resolution Fest, October 1st through 8th, all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. My guest, the fabulous Kathy Jetnell Kiesner, is on her way. And as you all know, Portland traffic is not what it used to be. And so, but while I'm awaiting her arrival, I would love to give you an update on yesterday's Portland City Council meeting. You may know that Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has negotiated a contract with the Portland Police Association, and yesterday was supposed to be the, oh, blessing, what a great, wonderful contract you've negotiated. Let's just vote it in and call it a day. However, other than Mayor Charlie Hales and Portland Police Association, they are the only ones that think that the contract negotiated behind closed doors is a good one. Myself and many other community members testified yesterday that what this contract represents is status quo with a lot more money. So we're going to pay retiring police officers to come back on the force, and the contract that's been negotiated has no criteria for determining what police officers we would like to retain and what police officers we would be happy to see retire. And so I guess good news, bad news. Yesterday when we left the city council, the mayor had said that next week they would be voting on that contract. I heard on the news last night that that contract vote has now been delayed to October 13th. And so we, the community, had an impact yesterday. I think sometimes that it's a waste of time to go and actually speak truth to power at the Portland City Council. But our collective voices were heard yesterday that a contract that does away with the 48-hour rule, which is the rule that allows police to not being interviewed after a deadly force incident, which has been part of Portland police contracts since the early 70s. That law, Mayor Charlie Hales was able to get rid of, in his negotiations with the police union. But for getting rid of that law, he also negotiated body cam legislation with the police union before he actually negotiated it with the public. And so under his scenario, police officers would have the opportunity to review body cam footage before they wrote their written report. Now, think about this. We were annoyed that police officers, unlike you and I, had 48 hours before they had to give a statement about an incident that took someone's life. Now, under this new contract, the police may have weeks, they may have days, they may have months to actually wait for the video footage before they actually have to write a written report. The only exceptions are deadly force cases. And so if the public was furious that police officers had 48 hours, how does the city council think we will respond to police officers having an undefined period of time before they review video camera footage? And the other thing is, as a community member, why do they need to review footage before they write their written report? If they were there, if they are honest, if they are in the habit of writing exactly what happened, why do they need to see the video? Unless the goal is to make sure the written report, they can write a written report that fits their viewpoint based on what the video shows. I am very troubled that the mayor promised the public that they would have an opportunity to participate. His ordinance said that there had been 6 community meetings, widespread community engagement. What it didn't say was that one meeting had 12 people, another meeting had 30 people. Not sure how many people came to the third public meeting, but the advertisement happened either the day before or 2 days before the meeting. So there was really no intention of getting the public truly engaged. And I participated in one of those meetings, and Chief O'Day and then the mayor confirmed that there would be no policy until the public weighed in. But again, all of a sudden, behind closed doors, a contract was created. And so the contract raises the starting salary to $60,000 for a police officer who graduates from the academy. The city personnel who presented to the city council said Portland police are the lowest paid police officers in Oregon. And I don't believe that's true. And I've seen several examples where I believe Salem police officers make less than Portland police officers, for example. So the whole contract is about money. It's not about vision. It's not about 21st century policing and how we become a model for community policing. And then listening to Daryl Turner on the news last night talking about, we want to be out in the community building relationships. We want to engage people. We want to know our community. Since when? They've had all kind of opportunities to engage the community. And the other thing is that the most expensive police officers are the ones who will be first in line for all the overtime that Portland police enjoy. And you may remember that Portland police have never not overran their budget by at least $4 to $6 million, and all of it is always in overtime, and it's always the public's fault. It's amazing to me that we can have hundreds of police officers standing by when the community has a protest, but yet they come to the city council and say they're desperately understaffed. But yet we have Portland police officers working for for-profit businesses in uniform, making as part of a deal that will allow the police chief to assign police officers to work in these for-profit industries. You cannot make me understand how we can have a police shortage, but we have more than enough officers to stand at an Apple store all day or to stand at a Microsoft store. We have officers that can hang out at Target in uniform, but we need to desperately incentivize becoming a police officer in Portland. So if you are currently a Portland police officer and you get your buddy to join, then you could get up to $1,000 or $2,000 in a bonus once they are sworn in. And then after they complete their probationary period of 1 year, you will get that bonus again. This is if you are currently a Portland police officer. So again, with no criteria, just because you're a buddy of someone who happens to be a police officer does not make you qualified to be a police officer. However, under the proposed contract, that would be an incentive for you to go out and get your network to then apply to be police. I think that we need a police commissioner that has a vision about 21st century policing. We need a police commissioner that will engage the community about what policing should be. We live in a community where crime is down all across the board, but yet we keep being told by the police that we're in a desperate situation. The desperate situation that we're in is that we have had a lack of leadership to make sure that Portland Police Bureau adopts to the mandates from the Department of Justice Settlement Agreement, as well as to totally fundamentally change their culture to be one about inclusion, cooperation, working collaboratively, and not one about control, mandating behavior, and demanding that people do what they tell them to do. Policing is a partnership. And when the community decides that they don't want to be policed the way that we are being policed, it is time for the police organization to change. And so the good news is that the city council heard a lot yesterday, but they need to continue to hear from you. I just don't understand how these backroom deals get cut in such a way that it totally cuts the public out. I am absolutely frustrated with the whole body cam conversation because, A, that is a public policy decision. Why are we having that conversation as part of the Portland Police Association union contract? Policy should not be in the contract. The contract is about workplace conditions, hours, vacation, retirement. That's what you have a contract for. You do not put public policy decisions in a contract. That's why we elect elected officials. And the fact that from the mayor's own mouth, he says he negotiated this for 6 months and it was hard fought, and he appreciated the union being willing to stay at the table. Well, of course the union stayed at the table. They got $10 million over and they get a 9% pay raise over the next 3 years. Why wouldn't they be happy to be at the table? Why wouldn't 95% of police officers say, yeah, I'll take a raise? I was so, so annoyed to hear Daryl Turner talk about, oh, yeah, I've had officers coming up to me that were about to retire. But now that we're going to get this windfall, they're going to hang around. Are they officers that we, the people, want to hang around? I don't think so. And I think if they were, they would be much more visible now and actually building the kind of police force that we want. It's clear that the culture will only change when we are able to incorporate a strong police chief and a strong police commissioner who have a shared vision of what policing should look like, and that they are working cooperatively with the community to ensure that policing happens the way it needs to happen. Were you at the city council meeting yesterday? Did you look at a live stream? Did you contact your elected officials about this contract? I have a few more minutes before my guest shows up, so feel free to give me a call at 503-231-8187, and let's have that conversation. It's not over. We have the opportunity to really have an impact. Oh, the big thing is, you may not know that the Portland Police Association contract is not even up for renewal yet. The current contract does not expire until July 1st of 2017. We have a new police commissioner that takes office on January 1st of 2017. Why would the outgoing police commissioner lock in a contract that we then would be holding a new police commissioner accountable for when he had no say in the contract particulars. And what we know is that once you put something in Portland police contract, it takes decades, about three decades, to get it out. And my proof, the 48-hour rule. Nobody remembers how it got there, but there was all this science. Every time we brought it up at a contract talk, the Portland Police Association says there was science that said that police officers needed that 48 hours so that they could clearly articulate what the events were, because they were too emotionally something or other to be able to actually give a statement on the spot. Ironically, the public can't use that argument, but it's interesting that they gave up this, what they said was psychologically proven data. They gave up this for money. They gave up the 48-hour rule for money. But the police union is much smarter than the city negotiators because, yeah, they gave that up at the same time they mandated that they got to see body cam video before they wrote their written report. Now, if we can't get police officers to tell us what happened in 48 hours, how long do you think it's going to take for us to get a report if they're waiting for to be able to review video? Think about 900 police officers, say 500 of them are on the street at any given time, say an eight-hour work shift, that's a lot of video camera. And who is going to be the one reviewing all that camera information for us? That is the question. Again, the city council has put off that vote until October 13th. I am thrilled that the public was heard, but I think that the city council, all five of them, need to continue to hear from the public so that they will know that this is unacceptable and the community will not accept them just developing a contract that is singly beneficial only to the police association. We, the public, deserve so much more. We, the public, deserve better. The good news is that the good guys won yesterday, but just like all the other backroom deals and negotiations that are taking place at City Hall, we, the public, have to stay mindful and watchful, because who knows when something else will be slipped onto the city council agenda that we will have to address. And so, that was yesterday. You could go online. At some point, the city hall will post the video from yesterday, but it has been posted all over Facebook by many of our community videographers. And we are always grateful when our community videographers show up and are able to participate in that way. So October 13th, it's a little ways off, but not that far off. But we need to make sure that that the police union contract actually serves the people of Portland and is not so one-sided that the only people who benefit are people who are in uniform. After all, the people in uniform work for us. And for them to be guaranteed a 3% raise every year for the next 3 years with no concessions for the public about how they're going to engage the public is just a horrible way to develop a contract. I understand contracts. I understand unions. But we are talking about police officers who have life and death decision-making opportunities. And so I just want you to keep the heat on, make sure that they know that this, in fact, is the right, that you want a contract that's actually fair, and we want a contract that's negotiated by a police commissioner that we can actually hold accountable. And so, okay, enough of my rant. My guest is here. Yay. Good morning, Kathy. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. I'm gonna do an appropriate introduction, so I'll give you a chance to breathe and just relax. You're with family, so thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kathy Jetnell Kistner will be speaking this evening as part of We Are Not Drowning, We Are Fighting at the First Unitarian Church from 7 to 9 p.m. That's located at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. And this is a program, a night of poetry and conversation. This is a program put on by APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. And we invite you to be there. You can go to KHANH at APANO for ticket information, or just show up a little bit early, and you will be welcomed. And so I want to tell you a little bit about Kathy. Kathy Jetnell Kistner is a Marshallese writer. Mm-hmm. Her writing highlights the traumas of colonialism, racism, forced migration, the legacy of American nuclear testing, and the impending threats of climate change. Bearing witness at the front lines of various activist movements inspires her work and has propelled her poetry into international stages. She is also co-director of the youth environmentalist nonprofit Joe Jecum, which empowers youth to work towards solutions to environmental issues threatening their homeland. For more information, I have her website on my Facebook page. And I just want to say welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
And I want you to know that your poetry has already made me cry. And so I want to just jump in, so we don't, because we only have a little bit of time.
Okay.
And I also, and luckily you and I get to talk twice today.
Right.
How cool is that, right? Yeah. You and I will talk this morning, and I will be interviewing you this evening after you present some poetry for the audience. And so we get to start and end the day together. I love that. And so I think the biggest question that I should start with is, where are the Marshall Islands?
So the Marshall Islands is located in a group called Micronesia. Mm-hmm. That's a group of islands, and it's in the northern region of the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, we in the U.S., we are really bad at geography, right? So when you start talking about places, people go, what? Where?
I don't know all the states. So.
Well, good. Well, we share that then. And so I know that the Marshall Islands has this history that is U.S.-based. The U.S. government did nuclear testing on your island.
Yeah, they did. They detonated over 60 nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands. One of them, the biggest one, the Bravo shot, is said to be, I think, like something like 100 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. So it was a crazy amount of nuclear tests. And we, yeah.
And when was that?
This was after World War II.
Okay.
Yeah. So they came and, you know, liberated us from Japan.
We're doing air quotes for you on the radio.
I mean, it was a difficult time during the World War II. And then they came in and they established, we became a part of the Trust Territory, all of Micronesia. Mm-hmm. And after that, they began nuclear testing in the Marshalls. Yeah.
And so so this was right after World War II. And you said that they considered themselves liberating your islands. But then they started doing nuclear testing.
Yes, yeah.
Did the islands have any say in the nuclear testing? How did that process, whole process work?
Well, it was a very messy, vague, and honestly very deceitful process, because the way they explained to the islanders, you know, at the time was, you know, it wasn't going to be that big of a bomb. They didn't really demonstrate how much damage this bomb could possibly create.
Right.
And then they also said this would end all world wars, that this is for, you know, the good of humankind.
Right.
And, you know, and we were religious people.
Right.
You know, we were very religious people even back then, and even up till now. And so the people of that island, Bikini Island, that's the name of the island, they said, okay, you know, if this is going to end the world war, and, you know, maybe we'll be back soon. They said, oh, you'd be back pretty soon. They didn't, you know, they didn't say how damaged the island would become.
Yeah. So they evacuated all the
Bikini Islanders. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And where did they send you?
They sent the Bikini Islanders to Rongelap, which is a smaller island, and it had poor resources. So not only did the Bikini Islanders lose their home island, which was the biggest island in our chain, I add, but they also were shuffled to this tiny island where they were starving for a while because it's poor resources. It didn't have the same amount of resources as Bikini. So there's just so much layers to the issue, you know, when you start to really peel it and understand the history behind it.
Right.
But either way, we got a horrible end of the deal. Really awful. Yeah.
Yeah, which is pretty much any place on the planet that the U.S. has gone in to liberate, right?
Yes.
I was talking to an Iranian woman just recently who was sharing a story about how she got to the U.S., and it just breaks your heart because we as Americans don't hear the individual stories about how our practices and policies really impact people.
Right. I mean, nobody even knows that the bikini that women wear is named after the Bikini Island. And the whole reason why the French designer created this bikini suit, he said it has an explosive effect on men, and he was inspired by the nuclear bomb detonated in Bikini Islands.
Wow.
So every bikini you see is literally, you know, its roots is in this nuclear history.
Wow. Yeah. And so, so your people, were they... when they were liberated, did they become American citizens? How does that...
No, I think during this period, there was some concern with wanting to be not seen as colonizers. Uh-huh. I think there was a turning tide in history where... I can't remember I think it was John F. Kennedy who was saying that, like, you know, we no longer support colonization, so we want to support liberation.
Right.
And so they were supposed to support our country to become more independent. Right. So we voted. We had options. We were told, you know, you could either enter into a compact relationship or become fully independent or become a territory. So our country chose to become, to have a compact relationship. Uh-huh. So that's what we have now. Okay. We have something called the Compact of Free Association.
And what does that mean?
That means that we have free access into, you know, into the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily
need
a green card. I do need a passport, but I don't need a green card.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not as complicated to come in. And it's because of the fact that they're still using our island for military purposes and also nuclear testing.
And is somebody making money off that?
Well, technically they are funding our government. They're funding our country right now. So, it's a good amount. Our country relies a lot on the funding that comes from the compact.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's another thing that's a bit complicated because then, it's like we've been kind of, forced into too much reliance basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
And if you're just joining the conversation, I'm talking to Kathy Jetnell Kisner, and she is a Marshallese poet and climate justice activist. And this evening, I know who that is. this evening, Thursday, September 29th from 7 to 9 p.m., she will be at the First Unitarian Church in Elliott Chapel, located at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. And we will be having poetry and conversation. Mm. I wonder if you would be willing to read one of your poems.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And can I pick one that I like?
Oh, sure, yeah.
You can tell me if you'd like to read this one. Yeah. The Red Glass Marbles.
Okay. Do I have it? Do you have it, actually? Because I haven't memorized that one. That's a new piece. I haven't memorized that one at all.
I have to tell you, when I read that one, it actually brought tears to my eyes.
Oh, thank you.
And it was just so... it was just so informative, right? Oh. It just told me so much. And let me say, when I saw the picture of your beautiful island, no one would know that this was, in fact, a place where nuclear testing had taken place.
Yeah, no. That's the island that, there's many islands. There's about like 60 different islands, you know, well, more. But yeah. Oh, yeah. So just read it.
Yes,
is that
please.
Okay?
That'd be perfect.
So this is a poem I wrote that was actually inspired by a camp that my nonprofit ran. Mm-hmm. It was a climate change arts camp, and it's the first one of the kind we've ever run in the Marshalls. And it was like where we taught kids how to use spoken word and also mural painting to raise awareness on climate change. So just to give that background.
Okay.
So it's just inspired just from conversations with these high school students, actually. So it goes, I am a mouthful of glass marbles, a rolled tongue stuck raw in my clogged throat, white man's burden, boiled syrup, sweet, slowing down my speech. When I was 6, I moved to Hawaii. Learned my name was no longer Tete, it was Kathy. I became blacktop negotiations. Tetherball tied tongues, a new culture to learn. When I was 22, I moved back to Meguro, a small strip of land, an ocean I no longer knew, a sea of blank spaces, a place that was no longer home. When I was 24, another Micronesian told me that girls like me are westernized, Americanized, therefore lost. I stood and watched my cousin tattoo a stick chart into her back, the buzz of ink, a map to find our way back home. When I was 26, I saw my last name spelled proper, just how it sounds, for the first time. I realized I've been shaping it wrong all these years for colonial ears to hear. Jet Nil Kitchener. How do you say your name? How do you say your country? Where is your country? Show it to me. Dance for me. Hang on the wall for me. I am a burden of representation. I am boxed in at the Bishop Museum, an indigenous voice woven for your display. Here you go. Step right up. Listen to this poet. Listen to this native tongue. Look, she walks and she talks too. But before, I was a label verifying contents. Before, I was a glass cage. Before, the water creeped up to our shores. Before, I learned not to trust that tide. Before, I was confronted with roots braided into a plastic umbilical connected to a mountain of trash that's consumed our home. Before, I was four. I was crouched slippers on the dirt path outside my home, shooting marbles, watching this world through a sea glass glow.
Oh, I didn't cry this time, but oh my gosh, that's absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
I just love how it captures the generational connection, right? Mm. To your homeland, to your name, mm-hmm. To your people. I just love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
You are very welcome. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking to Kathy Jetnil Kiesner, and she will be at the First Unitarian Church this evening at 7 to 9 p.m. at Elliott Chapel. So tell me about your work with young people and the environment. You have a nonprofit that
yes.
works with young folks. I'm excited.
I was
about
just
that.
Talking to Joseph about it. So I'm very new. I'm so new to this whole organizing environmental thing. So, you know, I'm kind of making it up as I go along. But I'm trying very hard. Basically, I feel like I have this platform. Ever mm-hmm. since I went to the United Nations, I suddenly have this platform to speak and to
yes.
be heard.
Yes.
But to me, it shouldn't just be me. I can't just be the only Marshallese voice out there. There's
right.
so much more stories, so much more, you know, right.
History,
right, yeah, yes. and experiences that these Marshallese kids, you know, have to right. share with the world.
Right.
And so that's the whole purpose, is that I wanted to create that space for these Marshallese kids to learn about the environment, to become voices for our environment, mm-hmm. To speak out against climate change, because I have this vision of just like, you know, bombarding the world with as many Marshallese youth voices as possible, you know, just like from every corner, you're like, man, that's another kid talking about climate change again, you know, like, and it's building. It really is,
wonderful.
You know, and it's, but yeah, it's taking a second because it's completely new. It's never been, you know, it's never been done, and it's a completely new nonprofit, and I'm learning how to run it, you
right.
know, as I go along. So yeah.
I love that. I love that. And what ages of young people are you working with?
Right now, well, this was our camp was high school students, mm-hmm. but we work a lot with more like college students.
Uh-huh.
So, because I teach at the College of the Marshall Islands, so I have this great kind of connection.
Yes,
that's my full time job. So, I just kind of like reach out to a lot of college students, college age students,
right.
college age kids. Yeah,
it's so cool because I mean, you look like you're about 12.
Thank you.
And so I could just imagine the kids are thinking, oh, she's one of us, right?
I mean, I feel like every time I go into a bar, people who see my ID just like laugh at it.
Right,
so.
Right.
No, but yeah.
Well, appreciate that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That work that for lots and lots of years. You know, when you talk about just being new to both climate change and organizing,
yeah.
it is so key mm-hmm. that communities of color mm-hmm. are at the forefront
I totally
of
agree.
This conversation.
Yes.
Because we know better than most communities
yes, yes.
about
yeah.
the impact of climate change.
Yeah, I think our communities have had the brunt of it, have had to, you know, deal with the brunt of it. Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. And it looks like we've got a caller on the line. So if you'd like to give us a call, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Good morning, Santi. Welcome to KBOO. Hi, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's great to hear. It's great to hear Pacific Islanders' voices on this, you know, especially with the API Underground and now having this lady come on and talk. It's really important to hear those things. I think it's great. A lot of these, you know, we live in a society that tends to have a amnesia. We have a short-term memory of the things that have gone on before, and I've seen so many people posting from, because I have a lot of friends in the Hawaiian community, and seen a lot of people posting from the islands and talking about the type of encroachment that's happening, the inshore fishing that's being pulled away from people, and land that people being kicked off land. Mm-hmm. I just appreciate that there's somebody coming on the line and talking about those things. I guess I had one question. What's something that non-islanders can do, because I'm non-islander myself, but is there something that non-islanders can do to help support API in, speaking truth to power and, you know, helping with deal with the effects of illegal annexation and colonization?
Thank you. Great question.
Oh, is that for me?
That's for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think, wow, that's a great question. Yeah. I think creating space for these conversations to happen, for these voices to be heard, you know, making sure that we prioritize that it's these islanders who are speaking on these issues, you know, rather than someone who lived there once or, you know, someone who happens to have studied about it, making sure we prioritize that islanders have those spaces to speak out and tell these stories, and then learning about, you know, their culture, learning about their history when you can, and supporting events that are islander centered, and you know, sharing what you can about when you find out these articles. You know, I think those are really simple, easy ones. But honestly, I think climate change affects everyone. It doesn't just affect islanders. It's a cliche metaphor, but, you know, they've called us the canary in the coal mine.
Yes.
So it's affecting the whole world, but it's just that people don't necessarily feel it right away, and they don't feel it, you know, they don't see it, you know, because they're not maybe... it's just not as apparent to them as it is to us.
That's
like in my islands, the ocean is huge. It's like right there on either side of you. There's there's plenty of roads where I could stand there, and, you know, the width of this office we're in right now, there's ocean on either side of you.
Right.
You know, so it's just so much clearer to us that, you know, we can see it happening right
away.
Because
it's up close and personal.
Exactly.
Right.
So, yeah, I think maybe that, you know, I think paying attention to how it's affecting your own life, too, is another thing to do. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to see, you know, because I'm definitely very vocal because, you know, like I said, I have lots of friends in the Hawaiian community. I've done a little bit of studying on my own. I've been reading a lot of, Moke Kupihea. He's one of my favorite guys to read. Great historian.
Wonderful.
And I just, I don't know. It gets frustrating sometimes because APIs are so invisible compared to a lot of other minority groups. And I just don't want to feel like being a mainlander, somebody who's steering the conversation in the wrong direction, when I'm really meaning to make sure that the truth is getting out, not necessarily what I'm trying to say. But
yes. Thank you. Thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. We got it. Thank you. Really, really appreciate that. I really appreciate the caller's point, because he's absolutely right. Many times API voices are really left out of the conversation. We're also noticing that as well with the Native community, right? With what's happening in the Dakota, we are really seeing for the first time in my lifetime, and I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but the first time in my lifetime, Native communities coming together to take a stand, and it is about climate change, and it is about environmental justice, and it is about our water supply, and so. Are you feeling that there's like this tilt that's taking place?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. You know, it's funny because I know about the DAPL because I found out one of the organizers, his name is Dallas Goldtooth. I met him in Paris, actually, when we were over organizing out there for COP21. And we as indigenous groups came together to honor, you know, the lives that were that was lost in the mass, you know, the terrorist attack that took place in Paris.
Oh, right.
And so we all kind of were just came just to show our respect, you know, and it was one of the more significant moments that I had in Paris when we were organizing out there, where it had it didn't necessarily have something directly related to climate change, but it was just about, you know, paying our respects. Yes. And I feel like I can see this connection between indigenous communities, and it's and we're creating these connections more and more. And so I would say, there's definitely a turning tide.
Yeah, and I've seen it with the African American community as well.
Right? Yes.
And so, because I think at least a decade ago, many of us that have been working on social and racial justice were doing that work primarily in our own communities, right? So, but I've seen this real phenomenal partnerships and collaborations and really creating spaces so that our communities understand each other and get to know each other better.
Yeah.
And so I'm hopeful. And what you're doing with young people, I think really expands that opportunity, right? Because young people, they just want to know, tell me about you. Who are you, right? You know, let's figure out what we have in common. Do we have another caller on the line? Hello, Karen. Yes. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
It's a real honor to talk to you and your guests. I have a question that is tangential. It has to do with whether there were elevated cancer rates after all the horrible testing on Bikini.
Yeah, there is. We had actually some of the highest cancer rates in the world. And then also, not just that, but there was a lot of miscarriages. You know, it actually affected our, you know, like our DNA, like our genetics, because women were giving birth to, you know, stillbirth, like all types of horrible things happening to women. It was terrible. Like we had something called jellyfish babies, babies with no bones. That's what we had.
Right.
We had to come up with names for these, you know, things that happened to us. Yeah.
How terrible.
It was really horrible.
I know a young woman who is a Marshall Islander originally and was adopted by someone in my Jewish congregation. And I just, thank God she's fine. But I just was very concerned about that. I'm a two-time cancer survivor myself, so that's what comes to mind.
Yeah.
In any case, thank you so much for the work you're doing. It's wonderful, and I just... I just will hold you in my heart. Thank you.
Thank you for your concern and for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you very much. And so you mentioned cancer. So you are freely able to travel through the U.S. as a Marshall Lease. And
we also have access to the health care.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, but do you face the bar? Do you or do you not? I mean, there's some API communities that have to wait 5 years before they're eligible for health care.
I don't think
in the US?
So. Technically, we're supposed to just have access, but the issue is that there's been certain states, especially Hawaii, that has been trying to kind of take those access and benefits away from Micronesians, not just Marshallese, but all the whole everyone who comes out of the area of Micronesia, because of the fact that a lot of us are coming into using to use the healthcare benefits, and I guess they're seeing us, they're kind of scapegoating us, honestly. But it's also that you know, they're saying it's a drain on the economy, the fact that they're spending all these millions of dollars on, you know, healthcare for these for this new immigrant group.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, that's been a bit of an issue. It's been a long struggle. Yeah.
And so it's. Have you considered like legislative action? I mean, it sounds like based on the history of the islands that you would be able to make a, of course, I'm knocking on wood and saying, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with the presidential election. this might be a mute point after that, right? But thinking in an ideal world, if Congress actually worked the way it was supposed to, there's possibly a legislative solution, right?
Yeah.
Your community, your people, your islanders, were promised, mm-hmm. were made a promise by the U.S. government,
yeah.
And they appear to be reneging mm-hmm. on that promise
yeah.
or trying to reshape it so that yeah. it doesn't cost them as much as it should. Right. And so, as I said, in the normal time, right, you would say, OK, you just call your congressperson and say, you know, won't you introduce this bill and, you know, make sure that there's this that there's legislation that actually mandates that, mm-hmm. you know, we keep our promises. Right. Mm-hmm. When we go into communities and we drop nuclear bombs mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. we destroy the environment, that we have an obligation mm-hmm. To make sure that those communities and those community members are whole.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I gotta say though, like, I'm not as familiar with that legislative process. Mm-hmm. I do know though that, like, I have a good friend, David Anidluk, who's Marshallese too, and he's been working with CAN, which is an organization that prioritizes the Micronesian voice and Micronesian rights.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've read and what I've seen, they've right. been really successful with organizing on behalf of Micronesian rights out here in Oregon.
Ah.
And so I think if anyone, I would talk to David and mm-hmm. see, you know, like, what are the, I still have to learn about what they've been doing, but I do know that they've been taking those steps, you mm-hmm. know. They've been taking things into their own hands and doing what is necessary, yeah.
Wonderful. And I believe he's at the program tonight,
yes,
right?
He is. Yeah.
So we'll be able to get those questions answered.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you want to know, you'll have to show up at the First Unitarian Church from 7 to 9 p.m. and hear Kathy Jetnell Kisner recite poetry and talk about climate justice. I'll be interviewing her, and I can't wait because I could talk to her all day, but I think she'd be a little tired by then. So today, mm-hmm. if you were going to say, tell me about the people of the Marshallese Islands mm-hmm. today. What's their experience? Are they able to even be on their island? Are they all displaced? What's today based on what happened during World War II?
Well, like I said, the testing mostly took place on Bikini Island,
right.
but there was fallout. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the wind picked up some of the nuclear ash and went to a few other islands.
Right.
So there's four atolls that are no longer inhabitable. And also there was one island, Wudilab, that was actually completely incinerated. Like, it's, you know,
wow.
like gone. And then there's one that we call Runit Dome
mm-hmm.
because it was like a hole that they put all this nuclear waste into and then just covered it up with cement. And so it's a runit. It's just this huge dome of nuclear waste in the middle of the Pacific. And it's actually cracking because of the rising sea level.
Whoa.
Yeah. And not many people know about it. It's just out there. It's actually, I think it's been named one of the World Heritage Sites.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are other islands, though, and mm-hmm. we are on all those other islands.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a few other islands. And we're living in those. But I feel for the Bikini Island. I'm not originally Bikini Islander. I'm
right.
from Mejiro, Jaluid, like these other islands.
Mm-hmm.
But, not Mejiro, sorry, Aur. But either way, the Bikini Islanders are, I feel for them because they no longer have a land to call their own,
right,
you know? And
right.
that is such a part of our culture, and that's mm-hmm. such a part of our history, to know, to be able to go back to that land, to know you always have that land,
mm-hmm.
you know, in your name.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think it's contributed to, you know, loss of a lot of cultural pride and identity in our communities, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you try to recreate it somewhere else, it's just not the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the same. There hasn't, you know, there hasn't really been enough dialogue with Bikini Islanders about how they're coping in this day and age.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like, yeah, it would be great to try
yeah.
to, you know, have a focus group or talk to some of the elders
yeah.
about what would
I
make
agree.
Them whole.
Yeah,
right?
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I've had conversations with my students, because
mm-hmm.
some of them are descendants of Bikini Islanders.
Right.
And, you know, we talk about the nuclear testing. And I say, do you think there's a chance we can heal? What would you want
right.
to do to heal
right.
our nation from this horrible legacy?
Right.
And some of them are just like, there's nothing we can do. There's nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, because there's so much that's been lost because
right.
of that horrible, we're crippled by it, you
right.
know?
Right.
Yeah, so.
Wow. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I am talking to Kathy Jetnell Kisner, and she will be at the First Unitarian Church this evening, starting at 7 p.m., going till 9. excuse me, the program will take place in Elliott Chapel. I think there's a couple of programs happening at First Unitarian tonight, so make sure you get into the right one. We'll be at Elliott Chapel, and we will look forward to seeing you there. What would you want people to know if people wanted to visit the islands, the Indonesian islands? Where would you recommend they go? What would you recommend they see?
Do you mean Marshall Islands?
I mean Marshall Islands. I'm sorry. Marshallese Islands. Yes, yes.
What would I recommend they see? I would recommend that they go to the little... So, like, it's a coral atoll, right? So there's, like, a ring of little islands that are kind of, like, close to one another.
Right.
And they create a lagoon.
Okay.
And so on the main island of Mindoro, there's little islands that are nearby. Mm-hmm. Those are really easy to get to. And they're, like... beautiful, they're clean, there's like crystal clear water, it's like an uninhabited island, there might be like one or two families at most just to watch the land, and you can take a boat there, and it's like a perfect day for a picnic, and that's what I would recommend. That's my favorite part of living in the Marshalls.
Right. Oh, when I looked at the pictures on your website, I was just like, oh, that just looks like heaven. That must be what heaven looks like.
I remember, that one is actually in one of the farther islands, and that place is beautiful. You're right. It was like a mirror. It was like looking at a mirror at the water and the ocean. I was like, man.
Wow. Right. It's been a long time since you could see that clearly in any of our water bodies here locally. Again, we've got a few minutes left. So if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's the number to call. Let's see. One other question that I had is... how are people engaging in climate justice conversations? And so we talked about the youth, but are the people in general just aware that climate change is happening?
In the Marshall Islands?
In the Marshall Islands?
Yeah, they totally are. Kids totally know what climate change is. Mm. And, you know, we're teaching it in schools and we're trying to develop curriculum to, you know, to discuss it even further.
Right.
You know, it was interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine recently, and he works for a nonprofit called Marshall Islands Conservation Society. And he was saying, you know, this isn't a development plan anymore. Like, we're not really looking at how to develop for the next couple of years. We're looking at, like, what are our options if we lose these islands? What are our options to you know, combat these changes to our islands, you know? So people are definitely aware, yeah. And plus, we've been having a lot of king tides.
Mm.
So king tides is when the water level rises, and just a mixture of different factors, high tide, wind, you know, El Nino or La Nina, sometimes... it'll send water over our seawalls and just flooding across our homes and into our cemeteries and just destroying homes. And that's happened 4 times recently in like the past like 3 years or so. And it's the most it's ever happened. I remember the first flooding I ever saw. There was just water all across the streets and like so many homes that were destroyed and people had to go into the schools. And I remember asking my mother, I was like, have you ever seen this before? You know, because she grew up out there and she was like, no, it's never been this bad before.
Wow. And so is your disaster planning taking place? I mean, are people trying to figure out now how do you you know, are we moving?
We're trying to figure it out. You know, the thing is, like, if we come up with a plan to move, you know, because other islands have done it. Kiribati, for example. Kiribati is another island in Micronesia.
Okay.
They have made it very clear that they're planning on relocating their islands. For us, we don't want to relocate at all. So we've made it very clear, and I know that most of our government has made it clear too, we refuse to create an evacuation plan because we're like, there is time and there is a possibility to save our islands.
Right.
So we are just trying to campaign as much as possible with the world to be like, hey, we shouldn't have to move.
Right,
we should be able to stay.
Right.
So that's kind of our position, is there's time.
And which means that there's a lot of things that not just the people on the island, but other people have to do around the globe to make sure.
So
job cut out for you.
I mean, you know. I mean, going to the COP21 was really like an eye-opener for me because there's so many ways to hit this climate issue from every side, you know, and our country worked so hard, you know, from hitting it from the diplomatic side to hitting it from the indigenous side to hitting it from youth side.
Right.
And so that's kind of what we're trying to do is we have a really good team advising us and we have a really good team of of people supporting us. Right. And it really does depend on everyone. It's not just us.
Right. Know? We got a couple of callers on the line. Hello, Nick. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hello, this is Dick.
Oh, sorry, Dick. Welcome.
Oh, no worries. Thank you so much, Joanne, for having your guest, Kathy, right?
Yes, Kathy, that's correct.
Oh, thank you so much. I was, first of all, the poem that you read just absolutely moved me, and thank you for putting your thoughts on paper and sharing that with us. That was
thank
just
you.
Really awesome. Mm. And the second thing, what you're doing is so great. You know, I won't bear my age either, but I've been around for a while, and I believe that distance from where the real impacts of climate change and other things create apathy, and then we're fed information that makes it seem so far away and not really a problem, that really telling us where the impacts are and how they're being felt by people who live there is so important. In your work to educate the young people to really become not just aware but active, to be able to protect their place and allow us who are at a distance to help. And I think many of us, like myself, want to reach out. So thank you so much, Kathy, and I'm hoping you will tell us where we might be able to contribute or help with your nonprofit that you're creating, because I think many of us, like myself, want to help you in whatever way we can, financially or whatever the case may be. But I just want to say how much I appreciate what you're doing. And thanks, Joanne, for having Kathy on the show.
I think
it's really helpful in telling about what we need to do to save this planet and save the people that are really in harm's way in their place of origin and birth.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
I will post Kathy's website on my Facebook page for Voices from the Edge, so as well as on the KBOO's site. So you will see that very soon.
I should add that our nonprofit has a website, and it actually has a PayPal donation button for victims of climate change. It's actually very new. We just kind of started it, and we haven't really promoted it, but... It's www.jojikum.org. Jojikum.org.
Spell it again one more time.
Sorry.
Slowly.
www.jojikum.org.
Dot org. Excellent. Thank you so much. And thank you for the love.
Yeah,
I felt the love.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank
felt
you.
The love coming through the phone. Who else we got on the phone? Good morning, Edward. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Joanne.
Hi.
How you doing? Kathy, thank you for being here, and Joanne, thanks for covering this. Again, sort of the last caller, as a person who's participated in environmental justice for a very long time, I'm just, and this may have been covered earlier in the show that I missed, but I'm just wary that, sort of like what the last caller mentioned, that people still think this is something at a distance. And for people of color and for indigenous people, I think this is an opportunity to really take charge in that the environmental justice was sort of subverted by larger, more well-funded mainstream people, the white population taking it over, and it fell off where in St. Louis, you know, there are radioactive playgrounds, and in Richmond, California, with emissions in black communities, there's just issues that are...
Oregon, lead in the water.
No.
Thank you.
Right, like in the schools,
now.
Right.
Yeah, wow.
So, you know, so I really hope that people understand that this is not at distance.
That's
our
right.
impacts are affecting people around the world, and people are losing land and their lives right now because of climate change. But
yes.
I don't know if people really in America really are, most people, are really ready to accept that it's happening right here, and their environmental justice issues that have still not been addressed, and climate justice is environmental justice.
Thank you so much for your call. I'm afraid we are running out of time, but I appreciate that being the last word.
Yeah.
Actually, Kathy gets the last word. Thank you so much for your call. Kathy, it's been such a pleasure to have you here today. Can't wait to have this conversation with you this evening at the First Unitarian Church at 7 p.m. at Elliott Hall. Mm-hmm. You are doing some remarkable work, and thank you for helping to educate us, because we're learning so much about climate change. And just like you said, you're learning, we're learning, but you're also acting. So thank you so
thank
much.
You. Thank you.
And we'll see you this evening. And this has been Voices from the Edge. I am your host, Joanne Hardesty, and I will see you next week. Same place, same station, same time. Have a great day. And thank you, John, for making us sound so fabulous. Have a good one.
Get up.
KBOO Portland, good morning. It's 8:58, and coming up, Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This last Monday, the Old Mole Hour at 9 a.m. on KBOO interviewed Teresa Rayford on police violence and the reluctance to investigate white racist vigilantism and attacks on black citizens. The interview was interrupted by continued technical problems. The interview will be replayed this coming Monday at 9 a.m. on the Old Mole.
It's 9 o'clock Cascadia time. This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Door-to-door mail delivery is being threatened. Congress is set to pass a bill